So this has beans and cauliflower and broccoli and green peppers and chicken, which came from Costco. No affiliation. They don't actually pay us a fee for me to say that. But Costco chicken is delicious.
Let's pop the cork on this bitch.
Start the game already!
I only say that because you had something that had a literal cork in it.
I don't know if that came through or not. This is the end of that vodka that I complained so, you know, horribly about back in like episode 15. It's still there. I have to get rid of it. I'm mixing it with Fresca. I hope it's drinkable.
I mean, almost anything's drinkable.
Yeah. We'll see what kind of faces I make.
Well, I am drinking Prince Eddie's Blonde Ale.
A beer?
Yeah. Different mood tonight.
Uh-oh. So how are things, man?
It has been a long couple of weeks. It's going to be extra long by the time this show's released, because I actually haven't finished editing the last one.
We're going to cut your pay. Honestly, like that stipend that you get for editing these things, it's cut in half.
Yeah. So, yada, 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 TLDR, I've had some family health shit going on. It's all good. Everybody's fine. But it's led to a long couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to get back in the swing of things now. I got some time set aside to get into some editing tomorrow. We're recording tonight. I hope to play some D&D over the weekend. Get back to normal. But it has been a hot minute. I was looking at, it's been like a month since the last episode released, something like 28, 29 days of the time I'm recording this. So
we're going to get demonetized.
Okay, I think it's a 3-strike rule the next. So what have you been up to, man?
Well, it's been an interesting week here, too. We have some friends that we were supposed to play on Thursday night, and I had to call it off because we have some friends, one of whom lives here now, and she rents a small apartment. And her mom is thinking about moving up, and they're like, hey, let's go look at houses, which sort of came out of the blue. But they wanted us to, because they've, I mean, they're not, Cindy and I have looked at a lot of houses over the years. We've renovated multiple houses. You know, so we know what to look for, what's going to be a problem, what's not going to be a problem. So they wanted us to come along and have a look. And so we went to look at some houses. And I'm flabbergasted by every time that we go and look at stuff here, there's only two kinds of homes for purchase in this area. Utter garbage and stuff that nobody can afford.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I mean, they've got a reasonably healthy budget. By which I mean, if you're careful, you can get something reasonable, but it's just like the craziness is worn off, but it's still, anyway. So I was sort of on pins and needles about whether or not we could play Sunday as well, because they were planning on coming up and doing sort of like final looks at stuff. But now that's not going to happen because they talked to the bank and the bank is like, nah, 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 nah. Anyway, money.
So, funny related kind of thing. I've been looking at houses in Newfoundland.
I'm sorry, what?
Strongly considering Tanya and I moving out east. This has kind of come out of nowhere in the last couple of weeks. Other than that, like, we're ready to slow down a little bit. There's really no other reason for this other than the complete unbelievable contrast there is between Newfoundland and almost everywhere else in Canada in terms of the housing market.
Yep.
You're probably thinking, if you haven't looked at it, yeah, I could see that being a little bit different. You look at the other maritime provinces, like Nova Scotia is not great for real estate. New Brunswick is okay. PEI is, I mean, it's all better than Ontario and BC because everything is. Newfoundland is bonkers, man.
Mm-hmm.
For perspective, like, I mean, I've got a bunch of houses sort of bookmarked that, you know, sort of represent something that, like, Tanya and I are like, oh, wow, that's a really great house. And then I look at the value at it. These are houses that would be in the Quinty market. selling for, let's say, very high threes to realistically, they're probably asking $450, $460
mm-hmm.
in Newfoundland, outside of St. John's. Bat House goes for $169,000 to $189,000,
which is based on inflation and realism. That's probably what they should be selling for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, economics, supply and demand. Obviously, the demand is generally low there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's other factors to consider. Cost of living, because it is an island, right? A very big island, but an island. Cost of living is a little bit higher. You think about things like cost of groceries and stuff like that. But we're still talking less than 20% above what we're paying in Ontario for houses that are a third of the cost. These are nice places in like nice, quiet, like a lot of them would be like living up in an area like you are, right? You know, small-ish communities, you know, not a lot of big cities in Newfoundland, but like even the cost of real estate in St. John's is, when you look at the averages across Canada, only about $50,000 above the provincial average there. I found a CREA tool for just doing comparisons and looking at trends sort of by real estate board, geographic area, or by province year over year. And like prices have actually gone up 5% year over year in Newfoundland, where in the Quinte District area, they've only gone up like 1%. But where average housing prices in the Quinte District area are still like just under $600,000. They're like $249,000, $219,000 in Newfoundland. And like Ocean View, you might not be waterfront, but you've got Ocean View. It's
you
nice.
You probably don't want to be oceanfront unless you're like actually operating a fishing charter, because it's cold in the winter.
Yeah, cold in the winter, you know. Storms, obviously, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, insurance costs be a little bit higher for some waterfront stuff there, I'm sure. But
probably taxes too.
Taxes are ridiculously low.
Hang on. They're lower than Ontario. Ontario is ridiculously high.
Yeah. So some of the areas that we're looking at, again, these are mostly rural areas, but, you know, within drive, you know, 20 minutes of a population center, not a big one. Property taxes are like $400, $500 a year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's really low.
Yeah. Like I had to double, triple take because I was like, oh, surely that's a month and it's, you know, a little higher than I would expect. But, you know, like you're looking at property taxes, even rural in the Quinte area, and it's $3,000, $4,000 a year kind of thing, like depending on where you are.
I was going to say like $500 a month doesn't sound out of step with a really nice house here.
Yeah. Nope, that's a year.
I think we end up paying like $200 a month or so. But keep in mind that we have like a community of, what, like 2,000 people, I think, maybe,
yeah.
Tops. And we have a hospital and we have a fire department and we have a police department. You know, you got to pay for that stuff.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Your area, I envision it as being like three parts small community, one part commune.
It's not far off. I mean, we started off as a company town. I was playing golf with a guy on Wednesday night. He's 87, and he came here in 1956 to work. And there was a guard on the turnoff at the highway. And you had to show, like, company ID to get into town. Times have changed.
For sure. So, yeah, it's not a done deal. We need to do more research. Obviously, I need to look at, you know, things like, what would moving look like in terms of my employment? Making that, like, I'm working technically remote now, but for an Ontario company, paying Ontario taxes as an Ontario employee, what would my employment agreement with work look like if I were to move out of the province? What would the impacts on something like benefits be, right? Mm-hmm. We have research to do, but with the information we have right now, I was shocked because my boss actually mentioned it to me at a staff lunch that we had a couple weeks back. He said, you know, Newfoundland's really good. You should look at that. And I'm like, no way Tanya would ever consider that. And I threw it out at her, and then I had already selected like a house as an example of what was on the market that I knew she would absolutely love.
Mm-hmm.
A really nice house, but it was like the colors she likes. Like it was curated to try and at least convince her to be flexible and think about it. And then she saw the price on it, and it was one of the nicer ones, and it was still $199,000.
I mean, that's doable. That's doable for a reasonable income.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it's realistically, depending on what we could put down, we'd probably be paying less or around what we're paying now for leasing. And the only reason we're not paying double or triple what we're paying now for leasing is we've been in this spot for like 17 years at this point, and they can only jack it up so much a year. Mm-hmm. So very, very, very doable. I don't know if we've discussed it on the show, but we were considering options like, Jesus, we really don't want to buy in our market, you know, in this area right now, because just don't know. Well, it's silly. And it's one thing if it's silly, but it's going to be the norm, right? Like if it's going to be silly and then 5 years, 10 years from now, it's still silly. So you haven't lost your shirt. You've just spent way too much. That's one thing. It's another thing if you buy in now and then the market tanks in 5 years, if you end up house poor or, you know, God forbid anything happens where we have to sell the house and it's like, well, we bought this house at 500,000 and now it's worth 280. Can't even break even on our mortgage, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, I don't think that like, I remember going through the, I didn't own at the time, but my mom owned an apartment building. I say owned, the bank owned the apartment building. She was barely making the payments back in the 80s crash, the early 90s crash. And I mean, like you say crash, but really what happened was is people stopped buying.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the prices of things didn't really come down so much, so I wouldn't worry too much about the bottom falling out. I would worry about if the value of the house doesn't go up by 2 or 2.5% every year, then you end up in a. But if you never sell it, then it's not a worry, right? Still, I'm excited about you telling me all about your seafood adventures.
Anyway, it's just something that like I told Tanya. And I was amazed because she was just like, oh, my God, I love that house. Let's move now. And it was like, OK, well, we probably need to dig into some stuff first. She's been going through the interview process for a job here. And depending on which way that goes, that might sway kind of how we would lean and whatnot. But I was shocked that she was just like, yeah, I mean, we really have no reason not to at least consider it. And I'm like, no, you're absolutely right. Because we were talking about things like, hey, what if we got like a motorhome or a trailer, traveled a little bit for a few years, you know, basically lived out of that, let the market sort of figure out what the norm is going to be and interest rates come down, and then we can make some decisions then. But for the cost of basically 1.5 nice motorhomes.
Yeah.
I'm finding houses that are built like post 2000. They're not, you know, a million year old houses in a really beautiful part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
The lifestyle wouldn't be for everybody. And even for us, it would certainly be an adjustment, but we're ready to slow down.
Are you ready to find out that pizza doesn't deliver?
Yeah.
Okay.
I went so far as to look at listings that included like an outbuilding, like either a converted like garage or something that was built to be a dedicated shop, like mm-hmm. a workshop kind of thing, just to see what availability on that was like out there. Cause that would have been the dream, right? Like that was never going to happen if I'm buying here.
No.
You know, the dream would be, Jesus, I'd love to settle down in a nice house, but have a dedicated me space. It'd probably turn into a bit of a maker space, kind of a man cave type thing.
Recording studio.
You know, the kind of thing that I would keep myself busy with as I ease into retirement in 90 years if I don't die before then.
Yeah.
Realistically, like I look at the market and the pricing there and it was like, holy shit, you know, I could realistically actually own a house and still hit an age where I could retire in it for a while.
Yeah.
realistically, like, and the market, obviously, I'm overexcited here. I'm over enthusiastic. But like, I looked at that market and I said, well, Jesus, like, I mean, there's not a pension in my future. I mean, I wouldn't count on even CPP in my future, realistically, by the time I get there, the way things are going. But as I slow down, I've always looked at things like, well, you know, an investment property that I could take care of and lease out and, you know, have that sort of be my way of looking at a retirement, something that always interested me. But in this market, I just couldn't see it ever happening, right? Unless I won a lottery or something like that. It was like, be lucky to get one house.
Yeah.
And I know we've had some conversations about the idea of things like investment properties and the stuff, sort of from a negative sense, right?
Well, yes and no. Like I have kind of a love-hate relationship with the idea of being a landlord. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, I would hate it because it means that I have to deal with people, which we both know I love. But it really depends, right? Because the only objection I have to the landlord thing is when someone buys a house, leverages themselves to the tits, and then rents it out for their mortgage and taxes and expenses, right? It's like, so what you've done basically is go, I've convinced the bank that I'm a good gamble, and now someone else is paying for my investment,
yeah.
Right? Like, there's a difference between that and, you know, like, hey, I've bought this thing, and I'm renting it out for whatever, and it's bringing in a little bit of money.
Yep.
Like, there's a massive difference between those two things.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and there's a like a predatory sort of nature to a lot of that. It's not just, oh, I'm renting this out for the mortgage and taxes. It's, you know what, there's such a high demand in this area that I am doubling what I would be paying out, bringing it back in. And, you know, this poor sucker has no choice but to pay for it because where else are they going to live? Yeah. You see a lot of that in the GTA area. And to a certain extent, it's even been happening here.
Well, here too. I mean, the reason that we bought this house is because, like, because we were going to wait for another year or two. And we were living in an apartment, and the landlord jacked up our rent by 4.5% the first year and 5.5% the second year. And I looked at, okay, like, they're never going to raise it by less than 5%. So what does that look like? And it turns out that the mortgage taxes and utilities, which I like when we sort of made the estimate for this house, worked out to, okay, we can live in the apartment for 5 years, or we can move into a house, which is like five times the size. And 5 years from now, the payments will be the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out that we actually overestimated the amount of utilities because this is a newer house than we've ever owned before. So it's actually got insulation. So, I mean, the furnace comes on like once in September and the house basically stays warm until spring. So it's been a pleasant surprise in a lot of ways.
It's nice.
Yeah.
So you had some nerdy shit that you wanted to talk about.
I did. I made some notes.
I got to give you credit. So normally we have this routine, and this is probably just because it's been so long since we actually recorded. The normal routine is I'll stick a doc up usually the day before or day of, and then we'll get to, you know, 4 or 5 hours before we're set to record. And the doc is still mostly empty, and then I'll throw some shit in there, and then you'll respond to my shit. And that's just kind of how we roll, and it's fine. But you hit me up like 3-4 days ago saying, hey, get a doc up. I've got some shit I want to write into it. And you filled it. Like, we might not get to talk about everything you've put here. I've contributed nothing in terms of topics, but I have some conversation around the edges of what you've got here that I'm interested in. So we'll get into it. This might actually be like serious conversation. Topic number one you've got listed is flexible morality in fiction.
That might be a little bit pretentious for what I actually want to talk about.
well, where's your mind at here?
Okay, so we watched through all of the movies in the MCU timeline. We skipped the Hulk movies, I think. There was one other one. We skipped the Immortals, I think it's called.
Eternals?
Yeah, didn't really enjoy that one all that much. But we got to the Legend of the Ten Rings, which I really enjoy. I enjoy all of the characters. I enjoy sort of the story. Some of the actors are awesome. I think there's just exactly the right amount of sort of quippy jokes in it. But something sort of struck me about 2/3 of the way through the movie, just before sort of the big action scene at the end. I always forget the actors and characters' names. Not important. Main action guy sits down and he's staring wistfully over the lake and reminisces about not being able to do the job when his father sent him out to kill someone. Mm-hmm. And he's sort of going, oh, I don't know if I can. I know that the right thing to do is to kill my dad because he's an evil villain guy who wants to release the big bad, who will destroy the world. But I don't know if I could do it because feelings, and is it right to kill someone? Literally, the scene before that was them fighting on the side of a building, and he kicked like 30 people off the side of the building. I guarantee you not one of those mooks survived, but no one cares because they don't have a name. Now, I get why they do that. It's the same reason that stormtroopers wear masks. It's so that you can use the same actors over and over again. It's kind of a shorthand for this guy is a total badass, and he's gonna mow through all of the bad guys. And these are bad people, don't get me wrong. But the fact that only characters with names or characters who are specifically individually important to the plot does anyone ever sort of moralize about. And I don't know if it's wrong. As I wrote in the doc, I'm a little bit conflicted about it because on the one hand, right, like the shorthand of how we tell stories in movies requires that you kill a lot of mooks. On the other hand, it would be really nice to not to worry about like, hey, you know, here was this big fight that we were in and a whole bunch of people died and I feel bad about that. And also, I don't want to kill my dad.
There's two angles that I want to approach this conversation.
Okay.
You're sort of focused on this is a problem with what we do in fiction. Like at least that's how you've sort of framed the conversation.
Yes.
And I'm thinking that it's more than that. Like, yes, you're right.
I agree.
We do this in fiction, movies, books, whatever. But there's also a very human thing to that. You know, there's a couple ways that you can look at it. We're a social species. Like evolutionarily speaking, we are a social species, even compared to, as best as we can tell, other hominin species. We will never probably know all the answers, but in all likelihood, a big reason why we are here and Neanderthals aren't are because Homo sapiens were a more social species.
We ganged up on them, I'm sure.
Well, there would have been that, but like, you know, the being social, existing in larger groups has so many spin-off effects from exchanging information, right? Like passing on knowledge from previous generations to future generations, being able to survive times of hardship, adaptability, things like that. But that social instinct sort of brings with it the kind of tribal behaviors that lead to a lot of negative aspects of our humanity too. We build relationships with the people that we know and recognize and we care about, and there's a disconnection with everybody else.
You may have just hit on the reason why socialism doesn't work, because you're perfectly happy to lend your neighbor your lawnmower, but a guy from two blocks over, you don't know him, you're not lending him your lawnmower.
Yeah. And then there's just, you know, the mind is trained to think smaller. So we lose track of, and I hate to bust out a Joseph Stalin quote. I don't know if he said it exactly, but he's often quoted as saying something along the lines of a single death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic.
Yeah, and it's true.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of truth to that. Typically speaking, when you're talking about a million deaths, you're not talking about a million people you know. But also, when you're talking about negative things in that scale, even if they are people you know, there's a diminishing returns on how you can feel personally, emotionally about that much. But I think even on a small scale, have you spent time on a farm?
Not in a very, very long time.
One thing people on farms, farm families do, if they're especially if they're raising livestock, like there's an unspoken rule. You don't name the livestock.
But it tastes so much better when it's got a name.
You know, you grow attachments to things like that when you name, you know. Like, I have no problem eating a hamburger, but I guarantee you I wouldn't have what it takes. And my family grew up on farms. I didn't, but I wouldn't have what it takes to slaughter a cow in a time of plenty that I live in, where I'm not, you know, feeding my family doesn't depend on slaughtering this cow. Like, I'm not a hunter. Very anti all of that. I could not slaughter a cow that I raised. And I would have a hard time raising a cow and not naming it. You know, like it would be a pet to me. You think about your pets differently than you think about wild animals.
To an extent, yeah. No, I get it.
I accidentally hit a squirrel in my car. It ruins my day. Like it legitimately ruins my day. I lose a pet. It ruins like half my year. There's this sort of evolutionary human thing where we latch onto the personal and we just don't build the same emotional connections with things that aren't.
Sure. No, and I agree. Like there's, especially when talking about things in fiction, or, you know, like John Wick, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Or things like that. Like you need a whole bunch of faceless mooks just to move the story along. And I get why we do it. I find there's a little bit of a disconnect when you are talking about the morality of killing someone and the sort of the differences between just the idea of, oh, I could never kill someone, right? Like that's more or less the statement he makes as he's gazing. And it's like, dude, you just killed like 30 dudes.
Yeah. And that is a little bit different, but
yes. Yeah. And I get that you're not as worried about them, right? Like they were assholes. You should have killed them. That's fine. Right. I would love to see someone do in a movie where like they sit down to have that conversation. And rather than go, oh, I could never kill someone, or to say that. And then, you know, whoever their conversation partner is says, well, yeah, but you just killed 30 dudes. And for them to say, yeah, but they don't matter because I don't know them. Mm-hmm.
And using that movie as an example, like they were there to try and capture, his character, and it's been a while since I watched the movie.
Like his sister.
Basically. Awkwafina's character, and then the sister. And they're hanging off the building. I know the one character was falling. I mean, you could at least have that moment where it's like, I killed a bunch of people. I did it in self-defense, protecting myself and the people I really care about. I feel horrible about it. And because I feel horrible about it, I'm afraid that I can't, in a non-reactionary sort of situation, choose to do that even if I know it would be the right thing to do. Like, I think you could make that fit.
Yes, I agree. And that's exactly what I mean, is it's like just show the contrast between those two things, because they are very emotionally different, obviously. Mm-hmm. Right? Because doing something where it's like, hey, somebody's punching me in the face or swinging a sword at my head. Yeah, I'm going to do what I can to stop them from killing me. It's just, when you put it in simple terms of, I don't know if I could kill someone, basically what you're saying is those weren't people, mm-hmm. right? And to come at it from a different kind of thing, it sort of got me thinking about how we, as a social species, treat each other, right? And it comes into, again, that thing where, like, you would lend your lawnmower to your neighbor, but if somebody in the next province is like, I don't even have a lawnmower, you're like, well, I don't care. That's not my problem. Right. Where when we look at, because I hear people that I talk to on a daily basis, they'll, you know, like they'll name drop somebody who's not super important, but it's like, you know what? Oh, yeah. You know, John Smith came up with a solution to that problem. So it's a good solution. Is it, though? If the solution can't stand on its own without John Smith having created it, then it's, you know, we attach this sort of mystique to individuals that we know. Mm-hmm. Right. And here's an individual who is worthy and everyone else is unworthy. I hear it in a lot of political rhetoric as well. You know, when you hear someone talking about those people, and it doesn't even matter who they're referring to, it's just people I don't know. people I've had no experience with, and therefore I assume that they are lazy and useless. Anyway, it is a little bit of a heavy topic. I mean, I thought we're going to come up with some jokes about how kicking off people off buildings is cool, and it's kung fu, so it's fine. And then we had a serious conversation about it.
Well, it's an interesting topic because you don't, unless you're looking for it, just realize how prevalent it is.
Yeah.
To expand on what you were saying about, you know, other people, there has been, historically speaking, especially in like extreme cases, let's say Nazis, for example, of strategic dehumanization of that other people to the point where, you try and convince people that they are subhuman. And we do this like strategically in the way we portray fiction as well. Yes, stormtroopers, the reason why they wear masks is that, A, you can reuse actors, it's cheaper, whatever. But also it is to dehumanize them so that you can have your heroes killing them and you're not questioning the morality of your heroes instinctively or subconsciously the way they would if they were killing people, you know?
Yes.
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit when we talk about table talk stuff, and I find myself a bit of a hypocrite in the way sometimes I've portrayed stuff in the past, but there isn't a significant difference between Nazi dehumanification of Jewish peoples and look at the way that orcs were portrayed in Lord of the Rings as an example, right?
They were there.
There is a significant difference in that, you know, the Jewish people that were persecuted by the Nazis were actually real people, and the people in the books, the orcs in Lord of the Rings, never existed beyond the fiction, but the mechanics of
how people perceive them, yeah. Because they are basically designed as a fictional thing to be subhuman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see how it's in table talk, like in D&D, it has come up a lot over the course of me playing the game. You know, like one of the things that DMs used to love to throw out is, you know, like so you fought off the band of orcs and now you hear a noise in the back of the cave and you find, oh, here's all their children. Well, they're orcish children. What do you do? Right. Well, they're evil by nature. Well, yeah, but they're children, right? And I mean, the discussions that happen around the table when you're all like 12 and 14 years old are not deep by any means, right? But there's some fairly, like, I've seen friendships ended by that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I honestly still, like, you know, 40 years later, I don't have a good answer to that question. Because on the one hand, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Like, these are children. Do you just leave them? They're going to die. You know, or are these evil creatures? Well, do you kill them? They're defenseless. Like, do you take them to an orphanage? They won't accept them. Like, what do you do? I don't know. There's no good answers to that sort of fictional scenario. In real life, we should just treat, you know, each other with respect, regardless of race, color, creed, or religion.
I guess the reason why I bring it up is that I'm guilty of, as a younger person, not recognizing that in the fiction. I mean, like, yeah, you recognize it even as a kid, but not, you don't really think about it the way you probably should.
Yes.
You know, I'm embarrassed to say that there were times when I was very much not a child that I still didn't think about that stuff probably the way that I should in the context of fiction.
Yeah, and I'm still guilty of that, which I will get to. That's a point that I need to bring up, actually, when we get to the book report, because there's some stuff there. Anyway, that's a very, very deep and, you know, sort of nuanced analysis of dude kicked some people off a building and didn't really seem to care and then talked about not wanting to kill people.
Yeah. And
I found that a little bit illogical.
Strange thing to get into for a golf podcast, right?
Right. Okay, well, that's a segue. So this is the golf segment of the show that no one asked for and no one wants to hear, but I have to brag a little bit because a miraculous thing happened to me last Sunday. I went out to play 9 holes with some friends, which I do pretty much every weekend. One of them is a complete beginner. He's played like 8 times. So we you know, try and bring funny games into the thing. And I was sort of concentrating on making sure that, you know, he was comfortable, that he wasn't feeling, you know, out of place or out of pace. Because up until this point, he really hasn't played a round of golf. It's always been, you know, hit a few shots, pick it up, drop it near the green, or play a scramble with somebody, that kind of thing. So we were all playing our own balls, and I wasn't really paying attention to my score until I got to the 7th hole and realized that I was 1 under par. And I finished 9 holes 1 under par, which is a record for me by some margin, right? 3 or 4 strokes. Now here's the interesting thing. If you are a golfer, I finished 1 under par for 9 holes and I didn't make a birdie. I made 1 eagle and 1 bogey. So,
wow.
It was a pretty spectacular day.
It surprises me that, I mean, I know you've played golf for a long time. 100 par is pretty good, but it surprises me knowing that, like, you've played on some of the shitty, like, Bayview par 3 courses and stuff like that, that you haven't done that before on those.
It's kind of funny. I mean, I had broken 80 at Oak Hills, which was a great place to start as a beginner, but I went back and looked at it recently, because last year I broke 80 again, and I now will say that I have broken 80 for the first time actually legitimately, because I looked at Oak Hills and it's like, oh my God, like some of these par fours are basically par threes, right? And like, it's wide open. It's a giant field. The funny thing is though, is that like making a par on a par four, even if it's really short and really easy, still requires 4 good shots. And the difficult thing about golf is that, like, hitting 1 good shot is reasonably easy. Hitting 2 good shots in a row is tough, because you lose focus. I mean, I lost focus. I got to the 9th hole. It's a par 5, and I was on the green in 2. I'm like, I can make another eagle. That was a pretty long putt on that one, but I 3-putted it for a par. So, you know, just you get excited, you lose focus, and then it's like you miss by a half an inch, you miss by a half an inch. So I was very proud of myself. And then I went out and played League Night on Wednesday and shot 47 instead of 35. So golf is hard.
Well, hey, do you want to talk about video games briefly?
Sure.
I used to be an adventurer like you.
Stay a while and listen.
I still want to know, where does that "I used to be an adventurer like you" come from? Is that from a TV show or something, isn't it?
Skyrim. I used to be an adventurer like you, but then I took an arrow to the knee.
I know the quote. I'm just like, I'm trying to place it in the game. It's been a while since I've...
Literally every guard you talk to in almost any of the towns.
Oh, you talk to guards?
I can't remember if they said it in Oblivion too. Definitely in Skyrim though.
Yeah, I didn't play Oblivion very much. I don't think I ever talked to any of the guards. It's like, if they didn't have some kind of a fancy cape, I didn't bother talking to them. In any case, going on about video games, I'm finding myself quite burnt out. I look at the list of video games on my desktop and I think, I need something that is a game as opposed to a giant story that you're taking part of.
I have a recommendation for you.
I was hoping you would.
Now, I need 2 things from you. 1, don't dismiss the idea out of hand based on what I'm saying here. And 2, if you research the game before pulling the trigger on trying to play it, don't make a decision based on sort of your initial gut reaction.
Okay. Now I'm expecting like My Little Pony's First Adventure or something.
No, but like, it is a game that, unless you know about it and know just how much people actually love this game, like serious gamers love this game, it would be easy to dismiss it as something along those lines. And I'm pretty sure you've never played it. Stardew Valley.
I have never played it. I have definitely heard of it.
Yeah. So on its surface, it would be a spiritual successor to games like Harvest Moon. There certainly would have been flash games like Farmville and stuff like that you could have played on Facebook back in the day.
It reminds me a lot of Farmville.
And on its surface, that's kind of what it is, except that it is so much more. It is a role-playing game. It's got some exploration mechanics. It's got a lot of social mechanics. Yes, I mean, the basic setup is that your character sort of inherits a farm, and the core, I wouldn't even say the core gameplay loop, but the core gameplay premise revolves around building this farm back up and planting seeds and making sure they're taken care of and growing crops. But there's so much that exists around that. It is very much a game that you can sort of play in 15-minute increments if you want. You can play it for 12 hours and walk away saying you're fulfilled. You can play it for 12,000 hours and still not have had enough if you're a person that's really into it. I haven't played it for 12,000 hours, but I certainly put 120 probably into it at least in my first playthrough. It's one I've been meaning to go back to. It is just so utterly sincere and delightful. There's almost nothing about it that isn't completely charming. Now, it is a game that is sort of built to look like that old school style of like SNES era 16-bit pixel art 2D game. And not everybody can look past that in today's day and age. But it is executed extremely well. Most of the game was just built by a single guy and his vision. Everything from the game to the artwork to the music was just all this one guy. He's brought on more people to form a small team now. Most of it was just to sort of port the game to other platforms. And I'm sure they've contributed sort of creatively to the stuff, but like the game is still getting updates and additions and tweaks to features and stuff. Jesus, I don't know how long it's been out now. 10 years?
A while, for sure.
Yeah. It is just delightful.
Well, I mean, that's a heck of a recommendation. I will give it a try.
And it's not an expensive game. What I would say is, like, try it on your computer. Like, there are mobile ports of it that I've heard are still pretty good.
I don't like doing things on my phone. Like, my eyes are not as good as they used to be, right? I am old now. So, big screen is better for me.
And what I would say is that it's a game that deserves your attention. Like, I find often when you're doing stuff on the phone, it is easy to, like, half pay attention, right? Like, that's what the phone is. It's the mindlessly doing something while you're focused on something else device. And when you try and game on it, I've found, at least personally, that I've fallen into the trappings of only half paying attention to the game. And it is a game that very much deserves your attention. So I would suggest picking it up on your computer. Your machine's not going to break a sweat playing it. Don't make any judgments until you've put 4 hours into it. And then go from there. Obviously, the mechanics of the farming and stuff like that, which is one thing. But then there's this whole town that your farm is built outside around, filled with people that you get to socialize and sort of help out. You start to pull bits of story out of everybody in the town and form relationships with them. And there's sort of a town story. You know, there's something that's happening in the town that you can kind of steer in one direction or the other. There's just all sorts of things. It's delightful.
All right, well, I'll have a look.
I think it's exactly the kind of game you need. It's a good palate cleanser in general, but like if you're looking for something that is very much not every other game you've played in the last 8 years, Stardew Valley.
There's been a lot of, it's funny because we used to play a lot of sort of, I don't want to say niche games, but a lot of games that didn't quite hit the radar. And you'd sift through a lot of muck before you found something that was good. But recently it's been a whole lot of like, oh my God, what's the next new thing, right? Like Cyberpunk. You've got Baldur's Gate 3, Horizon Forbidden West, all of which are great, but they're big, right? It's a heavy meal. And really what I'm looking for is like, strawberry mousse, something pleasant and light and nice, and I don't need to have a big dish of it. I don't need to, you know, I don't like season it with hot peppers in order to make it work right. It's just this
Stardew Valley. exactly what you need.
I will give it a try. You play a lot more games than I do, I have to say.
Yes and no, certainly not recently. I haven't gotten into anything since finishing Jedi Survivor. I'm going to try, probably not this weekend, maybe next week, to dive back into the Cyberpunk expansion. I hadn't finished it. I'd gotten maybe a third of the way in it, and I was enjoying it. It wasn't that I lost interest. I just got pulled away.
Life gets full. Like, it just does.
And I enjoy playing video games, but so much more of my hobby time is dedicated to other things now, where video gaming was my hobby for decades. You know, I run a D&D game. I play in another D&D game. I occasionally record and edit a podcast.
you record a podcast fairly frequently. on almost a regular schedule, even.
Mm-hmm. But I do want to get back into Cyberpunk. I have actually been considering doing a new playthrough of Stardew Valley just because it is light, and like I would have no hesitation about like putting a few hours in on a weekend and then like not touching it for a month and then coming back to it, and I'd know where I was. You know, it wouldn't be a big deal to pick it up and put it down.
That's the thing that I'm finding with a lot of new games is it's like, okay, like Baldur's Gate 3, for example, I absolutely love, but I'm now in, I mean, I haven't picked it up and I haven't touched it in like 3 weeks, but you know, I'm in act 3 of an honor mode run and it's like, what have I done? Which character is this again? Right. And some of that is my own fault because I played through act 1 like 75 times, but it's just so big, right? It's this giant epic tale, and I'm looking for like Arkanoid, you know, something I can, and that's why I've been playing a lot of the, I've been playing Bloons Tower Defense 4-5, because it's just like, oh, I click on some things, oh, I failed, whatever.
Yeah.
Carry on, start again, whatever.
Yeah, and Stardew Valley, I mean, like the farming stuff, I mean, you could say that has that kind of minimum engagement value kind of play, but everything around that will suck you in.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a mindless clicker game, but it has those aspects. Like if you just want to turn your brain off and log in for 20 minutes and click some shit, you can do your farming and enjoy just that too.
Yeah. One of the things that I need to do is I need to fix my brain, because I have, like, the reason that I played through Baldur's Gate so many times is like, ooh, I found a thing. I have to absolutely maximize and optimize everything. And like at some point you have to just go, you know what? Some things are not going to be perfect and you just got to deal with it.
I have a recommendation for you with that as well.
Oh.
Turn the difficulty down. Play it on easy mode. Scroll through the story. I know that you enjoy the challenge of difficult combat, but you also burn out on it and you're missing a lot of easily digestible, really good stuff by limiting yourself to playing the game that way. Like, it'd be one thing to play it that way if you've played the game on an easy mode or vice versa, but to burn out and never actually get through Act 3.
I will get through Act 3. I will. I just have to not be... Like, I'm playing golf like 4 times a week.
Yeah, but like, you turn the difficulty down, you could burn through Act 3 in 2 nights and really enjoy it and be like, yes, I've got some satisfaction. You know, the things that were set up earlier, they've paid off. You get the good story, you know? Sometimes I think we focus on difficulty too much in games, as if somebody's going to judge you. And again, I know you enjoy the difficulty, and there's a second game in there, right? Playing at difficulty and having to be tactical and strategic. And like, that is a game in and of itself. But you're missing a really great game that is Baldur's Gate 3 by getting bogged down in and forced, like letting yourself have to feel like you need to optimize and feel like you need to, oh, there's this thing I didn't know I was going to get. Now I need to like completely change my plan entirely. Let me get out the spreadsheet. And, you know,
it's a thing. I mean, I was trained that way by playing EverQuest.
Yeah.
But I do that in easy mode too, man. It's not the game. It's not the difficulty that's the problem. It's my brain that's the problem.
Yeah, but on easy mode, like, You know what? I've played games that have gear and upgrades and shit in it. And like, I used to care about all of that. I mean, hey, I played WoW for a million years too. I've recently been playing games where I engage with them the same way I engaged with like Need for Speed Underground 2, where it's like, I got my starter little Nissan SX. And I mean, this is a good enough car. And I use it the whole game. Slap some paint on it, you know, some ground effects and some ugly ass lighting. The ridiculous looking thing ends up in the picture of the magazines that you get in Underground 2 when you play through that game. I've been doing that with games like, well, pretty much everything I've played in the last couple of years. Even like Starfield is like, yeah, I mean, I got a couple of upgrades that I cared about, but after playing it on harder difficulty for like a week, I just turned it down. And I enjoyed the game much more because I could tease out more of the enjoyable bits, you know? What you're doing is sitting down to a nice steak dinner. You got a baked potato, and you're trying to strategically balance your butter to sour cream ratio on the baked potato while the rest of the steak dinner's going cold.
Yeah, but you got to put the cheese and the chives and the bacon bits, and it's all got to be spread out evenly.
And that's good. Enjoy the rest of the game now. You could enjoy it in a couple of days. And then when you have the time and mental energy and you're in the right headspace, then come back and do the Honor Mode Act 3 or whatever.
Yeah, might do that. There's certainly some, I've been thinking about doing a dirge run just to see what it's about. Because it does very much feel like that's how the game was designed. So it might be worth doing that. I did, one of the things that I was quite proud of myself is in my Honor Mode run, I killed Karlach. And then I accidentally killed Mizura in the, you know, you find her under the, what is it called, in Act 2, under the Shadow Keep or whatever. And it's like, hey, come rescue me. And I hit the wrong button and she died, and that killed Will. Yeah, so, and I'm like, well, in regular mode, I'd want to go back and fix that. And now it's like, nope, I made a mistake. Carry on. Go forward. Not that I had much choice. It's Honor Mode. You can't go back and fix it. But, I mean, there's something to be said about that.
So you've been reading books, I assume, because you asked me about tracking down some books for you, of which I threw a lot of them at you. Want to tell me what you've been doing here?
Yeah.
A book?
That's right. When I was your age, television was called books. And this is a special book.
So I picked up a book from the Bain Free Library, which I had read before and I remember enjoying immensely, called 1632 by Eric Flint. And it's, the shtick is basically a town in West Virginia gets picked up and dropped in 1632 in basically Germany in the middle of the 30 Years' War, which I'm not a history buff. I don't know how accurate any of the stuff is. I do know that it is like it was like there was some amount of research done because there's like it feels reasonably okay. I remember reading it probably 20 years ago, or around that point, because I think it came out in the, anyway, it's not important. And I remember really enjoying it, and I'm reading it now. And as we mentioned previously, in the flexible morality, bit, like there's some parts of it that I just absolutely missed the first time that I read it. And I'm sure that there's still stuff that I'm missing, and I don't think that there's any malice in it, but there is very definitely an awful lot of commentary about religion and how they interact with each other. It's really interesting to read a fictionalized account of, you know, some Americans get plunked down in the middle of Germany and suddenly they're going to turn Germany in the 1600s into America, right? Like here's the Declaration of Independence, and here's the Bill of Rights, and here's the Constitution, and we're now going to impose this on all of medieval Europe.
Well, that'd be interesting, because like I would assume that a lot of that sort of deals with like the Holy Roman Empire then.
Yes.
Okay.
The Holy Roman Empire actually doesn't come in because I actually did finish the first book and I'm into the second book now. The second book is much more about that. The first one is very much about Adolphus Gustavus, the King of Sweden, who is kind of trying to do something because there's the various branches of Christianity that are all fighting with each other, mm-hmm. but they actually do a really good job of making it clear that yes, Lutherans and Calvinists and various other Protestants are fighting with the Catholics and the Jews. And there's some people who live in the hills who don't really do anything, and sort of highlighting the fact that the common people really don't give a shit. Like, they don't care. And the people who are actually fighting with each other, the nobles and the various kings and queens and whatever, are not actually fighting to try and make their religion right. It's they're using that as an excuse to just fight each other. So the first book actually reads an awful lot more like somebody made an outline. They fleshed out parts of it and left the rest of the outline in the book. Like, it really feels kind of unfinished. Like, the story finishes, mm-hmm. but the prose is not complete. And it sounds like I'm really shitting on this book, and I really don't mean to. It's a good book. The characters are compelling. The story is interesting. The premise is interesting. The dialogue is a little bit, like, I would almost say juvenile. I think it was aimed at not quite young adults, but young people in general. And I find it a little bit too, you know, rah, rah, USA. But it's not really in your face so much. Yeah.
It's interesting. I really hadn't heard of the series myself until you mentioned it. I did look it up while digging into the ebooks that you were looking for. And there's the mainline sort of books. But then there's
universe.
Then there's all sorts of shit that exists around it, and like that author seems to be involved in all of it. And I think I've mentioned this author before, David Drake, mm-hmm. who I forget how I got into the series of books. I would call them probably below average fantasy, but I realized researching more about the author that he'd got himself tied into like a really bad contract with his publisher. And he was basically on the line for like shitting out a full fantasy novel a year for many, many years. So
that's a lot.
Given the scale of the number of books that seem to be built around this series, I suspect that maybe the quality is a reflection of.
Well, that's a funny thing, though, is because like the first it's still good, but there's portions of it where. Instead of getting scene level view of what's happening, you get sort of a summary of what has happened. It's almost like there's a narrator in between scenes of a movie. You mm-hmm. know, it would turn out that Andy did escape from prison, and then you know they met up in the field afterwards, and then you'd see the conversation in the field. Right, that's what I mean. Like, there's bits of it that are not 100% fleshed out, but the second book. Which I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but it has two names on it. It's Eric Flint and it's David Weber. It's not really important. I'm about halfway through it, and it seems much more fleshed out. And based on, like, I think that I can spot two different styles in the book, so I think they actually did collaborate on it. It's definitely much broader in scope. Like, the first one was very much, you know, here's this small West Virginia town, and we're going to deal with the stuff that happens in this small West Virginia town in 1632 Germany. And then there's a couple of things where it's like something is happening off in the field, and we're not going to worry about it, but we're going to tell you that it happened. And in the second book, it's like, here are several different, you know, ambassador trips that they've done. Like, they sent somebody to England, they sent somebody to Holland, they sent somebody to France. And the I'm not sure how historically accurate it is, right? Because obviously it's historical fiction, but it rings true, right? It has not quite to the same level of detail, but the same kind of verisimilitude that Game of Thrones has. Like, do you remember, like, when I first read the first book of Game of Thrones, it was like, I'm interested in this because, like, there's politics going on here that feel like real people. Right, and the same sort of thing is happening in this series of books. Anyway, so I read a book. It was pretty good. I would recommend it. It's free. I would recommend the second one. It's not free. Yeah, I have no idea how far they go. I've seen a couple of comments from people who are like, you know, the first four are really good, and then it starts to get a little weird, which it would, because at that point you're now into completely fictionalized. You can't research what happened because you've made it all up now.
Yeah, that sort of speculative fiction stuff is something I've always wanted to get into and never really have. You know, I like a good what if scenario. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll check it out. I think I've finally decided to pick up a proper e-reader. I'm looking at the just like a cheapy 6-inch Kobo Clara black and white, I think is the one I've decided to pick up. I have an extensive library of like DRM free EPUBs and stuff, and the Kindles look like they might be a more enjoyable experience reading wise, but being able to work around their DRM stuff. And there's a couple of other reasons why the Kobo appeals to me. I think I'm going to go with it.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, I mean, most of the enjoyable experience just comes down to the e-ink, right? Versus staring at a tablet screen or a phone screen. And I'm finding now if I'm looking at my phone later in the evening, which is when I'd be doing most of my reading, I'm starting to notice the eye strain a little bit more than I used to.
Yes. Yeah, I can't do it anymore either.
Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, sit at my computer and read a book. I'd probably be fine doing it, like, with my eyes, but that sort of defeats the purpose. I want something that I can...
You want to lay in bed and read.
Yeah, or wherever.
Yeah, or in a hammock in the backyard.
There's a couple of fantasy series that I do want to try and make time for. Been on my radar for a while. I think I've talked about the Earthsea trilogy by Ursula Le Guin before. The other one that I think I might get into before is the Broken Earth series by N.K. Jemisin.
I think I've heard of that one.
You probably have. She's a phenomenal writer. Well, this particular series is the only fiction series that, like, all books in the series have won the Hugo.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's been cleaning up in that stuff, and not that, you know, that's my criteria for whether or not I read a book. Have they won a Hugo? But by all accounts, it's some of the best fantasy that you're going to read. So I'm going to give it a shot.
Well, I have another thing to add to your very long list of books that you should read. The Codex Alera by Jim Butcher. Jim Butcher is the same guy who wrote the Harry Dresden stuff, which is also really well worth a read, but the Codex Alera is a similar shtick to 1632. It's about the Lost Legion.
You've mentioned it before, yeah.
I have, yeah, and it is really, really well worth a read. There's a lot of weird stuff in it, and the first couple of books you're like, where is he going with this? And like, in the end, like, the conclusion to it is really well worth the wait, and it's not telegraphed, but it's set up really well, and the payoff is very satisfying.
I will add it to the list. Hey, before we wind down for the evening, do you want to talk about the game we played?
Yeah. Let's talk about shit I made up.
Now, you've prefaced this by saying some interesting bits happened to Rich's character, and then we missed a big part of what happened, and that was awesome.
It's one of those things where, it's awesome that you missed it. Right. And it's not that you missed it. It's that you sort of went in a direction where it wasn't. But we had a talk in the unedited episode from previously about just throwing you in a dungeon. Right. So I started off with, here's a dungeon with some stuff for you guys to fight. And I'm still struggling with the difficulty curve because you guys are just kicking ass on stuff that is a little bit above your challenge rating and that's fine. But in setting up that dungeon, like I said, there was a whole bunch of stuff where I went, oh, this would be cool. So I made a little note. Oh, this would be cool. And I made a note. This would be cool. And I made a note. And it was exactly what I needed. So thank you for the kick in the ass. Because I wasn't really ready to run a session, but it's like, here's a dungeon, we're going to do it. And there was a whole bunch of stuff that came out of that, which we will hopefully get into on Sunday. So it's one of those things where, like, when you just start to play, stuff happens and stuff comes out of it. And just the act of creating a little bit usually means that there's sparks that happen that create other bits.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope I can keep track of all of it.
Yeah, that is the big thing.
Yeah.
Because
my notes are terrible.
I tried to not kill everything. I don't know if you, like, noticed that I made the conscious effort during some of those encounters to, like, not actually engage in the fight. There was a couple of fights where it was just like, I'm just going to go stand up, because I knew, like, oh, I could probably, with my particular build right now, one shot whatever that is, and that's not fun for the other players. So I was like, I'm just going to go walk over here and make sure nothing's come at us from the other side. You guys got this. You go ahead. That was very much a conscious thing. Like, even after doing a little bit of a retcon on my kit to ease up some of the damage, I mean, I'm a Gloomstalker, early level Gloomstalker, but still, like, opening round damage.
It's big, yeah. And I mean that fits with your character too, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I'm trying to be cognizant of it though, so it's just not like, oh, here's an encounter. Oh, that's over, and other people didn't get to do anything.
Yeah, it's tricky like that. So I'm interested in what you think about the revelations that came out in Rich's character this week.
Well, you're going to have to remind me what the revelations were, because I'm looking at this note and I'm having a hard time connecting the dots.
Well, so Rich gained some hit points by killing a creature.
Okay, so you're talking about the weapon then?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that was one of those things where once it happened once, it was like, it was telegraphed enough that we were joking. Oh, sure would be a shame if this was some sort of, like, evil sentient weapon. And, you know, basically, at least where we left off at the end of the session, it seems like maybe the evil is sort of questionable at this point, but maybe, you know, it's set up to kind of be heavily leaning in that direction anyway.
There's some stuff going on there. I like, it's one of those things where you don't want to do too much about it, but at the same time, it's like, you know, I made a note 3 or 4 weeks ago, three or four sessions ago, you know, that because Rich is playing a rogue, and rogues often don't get a lot of stuff to do, right? Because it's one of those sort of like two sides of a coin. If you go into a dungeon with lots of locked doors and traps, you know, and the rogue is rolling lots of dice, but like, how do they fit into the story? Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it can be done, and it's not that, you know, rogues need some kind of a boost or anything, or that everybody else needs a nerf. It's just difficult to work a rogue in without giving them stuff to do that leaves the rest of the party out.
Yeah, and I think I'd mentioned in the recent arc I've done with my Tuesday group that I was doing some dungeon dives, and part of the reason I was doing it was to give my rogue a chance to be a rogue, because a lot of my game had been pretty just not dungeon crawly, you know, like it pretty cinematic. You know, I'm giving my people a chance to be heroes, but often that hasn't in my games provided a lot of opportunity for the rogue to use their tools to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been focused on trying to do that a little bit more. You know, it is a challenge in general with utility characters, not just rogues, but rogues are sort of the common example, trying to build narrative hooks around their tools, right? Like, you know, you think about a druid. I mean, it's pretty easy to build narrative and interesting plot and shit around their relationship with nature, the type of magic they do, turning into animals, guardians of this or that or whatever, right? Same goes for wizards and stuff like that, there's, you know, often you're building personal relationships of some sort with the people that you're facing, your antagonists. You know, there's more of a direct connection there with those types of characters. Or if you're after a MacGuffin, you sort of establish a connection to your magic users or whatever. And then the rogue is just like, oh, I slit throats. Like, you know,
yeah,
or whatever. Like, you know, it's an interesting, mechanically speaking, depending on what subclass they play, even trying to fit them in with a group that skews towards like the good side of alignments and playing sort of heroic roles, you end up breaking out of your rogue sort of archetype to engage with that type of stuff. So I like things like sentient weapons. I don't do it enough in my games just because it's usually what I build to like later game, right? Like it's kind of interesting to see you bust it out this early because it can make anything that happens later feel less special.
It can.
You know, you gotta balance that. But at the same time, like, it adds a layer of meta to actually playing the game that's interesting, right? Because, like, it's the kind of thing you speculate about, or even when it's happening in-game and it's being revealed. Like, you know, I'm posting little Shops of Horrors gifs in Discord while it's going on. You'll feed me, Seymour, you know, that kind of shit, because it's just...
Well, one of the things, it's sort of where I'm trying to go with it more than... you know, like, rather than it being like an item of unfathomable power, it's just like it's an NPC that's following the party.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it'll be interesting to see how Rich handles it. Right. Because you guys can't hear it. Right. You don't know what's happening. Right. I mean, the players know. Right. But obviously the characters don't. And just the, like there's some, I don't know, there's some interesting sort of twists and turns that you can put in there. Like, is it evil? Is it not? What's it? What is its motivations? Like, how did it become sentient? Why is it sentient? What does it want?
And the fun challenge with it is, if it's not OP now, I mean, it's, you know, pretty OP, but like, you create this interesting thing that potentially gets replaced in a couple levels when he finds +1 or +2, anything. I think of the Puffin Forest videos around some of the magic weapons that he's created. He's done a couple. There's the one around the broken sort of annoying weapon that was like a something of warning or whatever that he just busts out in the video. See, I warned you. I warned you. Oh, I laugh every time.
He's on the list of people that I would really enjoy playing a game with, I think. Because I think he would be fun. It's funny to see. I don't know if you ever watched any of his actual play stuff.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I've only watched a very little bit of it. It's sort of funny because it's that he has that voice that he does, right? And it's like all of your NPCs have the same voice, dude. It's an amusing voice, and I like it, but like
that borderline baby talk kind of, yeah.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, they're all in the same vein, and it's charming and it's wonderful, but it's like,
it'd be one of those things though. Like, you know, I enjoy consuming 15-minute videos.
Yes,
multiple 4-hour sessions with him as a DM. Like, if it was like that all the time, might get a little bit grating.
I think he really turns it on for those short videos.
Oh, I do, and of course he's sort of. I didn't watch the. Too many of his full sessions, but I did really enjoy his recap series for his Curse of Strahd yes. playthrough that he did. And of course, he's also voicing the parts of the other player characters.
Yeah.
So you get more of it than you probably would with him just as a DM.
Yeah. Well, and that's just exactly it. And I guess it depends on, like, it's one of those things where, I don't know, it's like the Dungeons and Dragons subreddit is so ridiculous. Where it's just like people are complaining about stuff. One of the things that popped up there, and the reason I bring it up is because someone posted the DM is a player too, right? Like we gotta keep in mind that like everybody needs to be having fun,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're not having fun, why are you playing? And so it really depends on the players that you have around the table, right? Like I think we're pretty blessed with the players that we've got for Sunday, right? Everybody, kicks in. Everybody sort of does their bit.
Everybody's different too. Yes. You know, like there's, I don't know that I would enjoy DMing a game where everybody was just playing a different flavor of the same kind of murder hobo, you know, which is a lot of games that, you know, get played or like that.
It gets boring.
You know, you got everything from Chris being Chris to my wife being the agent of chaos that she is to me trying to take it really seriously, but not really seriously. Mm-hmm. And it works out well. My Tuesday player is very, very similar, like good complementary pieces. They all bring their own sort of unique thing. I'm doubly lucky to be surrounded in both my games by people like that.
It's been good. I mean, I think I've mentioned before, like when we did Curse of Strahd, that's the longest game I have ever run. It's the longest game I've ever been part of. So,
speaking of giving my rogue a chance to do rogue-like things, she's playing a I'm drawing a blank on the rogue subclass, the one with like the psi powered knives and shit like that.
Arcane Trickster?
No. Soul Knife.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So like, you know, she's always doing a lot of psychic stuff. Like they got the psychic group chat up for the players, which is really handy because it gives them a chance to communicate a little bit when they wouldn't be able to otherwise. Mm-hmm. I've thrown them into that gauntlet thing that I was talking about. They sort of got through their first encounter a couple weeks back. I was shorter players, so they three men sort of a non-combat thing that was going on. That worked out really well, a bit of a puzzle. Got through some combat stuff this session, and then I've set them up, hinted at an encounter with an Aboleth.
Okay.
And a few sessions ago, they'd recovered a magic item that was sort of like a amulet of mind reading kind of thing that they stole from the one bad guy that's kind of thrown them in this situation when they were raiding his hideout. And she decided to try and use it. Once I identified that it was probably, and like I telegraphed it with like all the doors leading into these different challenges have different iconography and stuff on it. And one of the other players sort of recognized what it was sort of a big circular maw of teeth with three eyes positioned above it.
Okay.
Set it up as an Aboleth, and she, having learned what that is, tried to reach out, and she started communicating with it and has tried to make a deal. So I've set him up with what would, you know, could be very easily like a just, you know, combat encounter, combat encounter, combat encounter, combat encounter. They're the kind of group that's like, hey, maybe we don't need to kill everything in here.
That's special.
No.
Hang on to that. Yep. Both hands.
Yep. Trying to cut a deal with the Aboleth, the enemy of my enemy, is at least temporarily my friend until it tries to kill us afterwards. Yeah. Should be a lot of fun.
Should be. I always find it hard playing those. Speaking back to like letting rogues be rogues, sometimes you can let rogues be rogues by basically running the movie Ant-Man, right? You do like a kind of a heist, but it's really hard to, or at least I find it difficult to run that sort of thing because there's a lot of like super extra descriptive, right? And I find those kind of, what do you call them? Have you ever seen those Lord of the Rings comics where they basically made a comic book with stills from Lord of the Rings, and it's a DM trying to run it, and he's trying to like give people the background and the lore and all of this stuff, and they're all just like, I try to have sex with Legolas, and you know, this Strider guy doesn't seem very nice, so we kick him to the curb. It's like, yeah, you didn't listen to any of it.
Yeah.
Right. And people don't because they tune out. It's too much.
Yeah. And my experience with heists is that you can't drive it, right? Like you just set up, there's a thing, it's here. Here's the basic sort of like very high level details of the situation that you're in. And then let the questions that they ask and the sort of investigation that they do drive the heist. And then you just have to improvise around that.
It's a lot of improvisation.
It really is. And the difficulty in it, especially if you're doing it because you want to like let rogues be rogues, because that's where they should excel, is that it works really well at low levels, you know? But like, you don't have to get very high leveled before all of your magic users have enough utility spells to trivialize so much of what might be dangerous. Not even necessarily talking about like teleportation and flying and stuff like that. Like there's just something like a silence.
There's just so many things.
Right?
Yeah. They can do so much. It might be the kind of thing that you would have to do, like they almost have to go through a gauntlet first.
Yep.
Right. Because one of the things about fifth edition that's kind of funny is that you're supposed to run 5 or 6 encounters a day, right? Which most people don't. So it ends up with like your spellcasters are massively overpowered because they can just more or less mana dump and then go, well, I don't need any more spells because we're in a long rest in 5 minutes.
Yeah. And that's the difficulty knob that a lot of DMs struggle to turn is rest, yeah. Right? And like I try to walk that, I don't want it to become a like a micromanagement thing in my game. So I basically do what you do. If you're out of combat and there's no imminent danger, a short rest is possible, right?
Yes.
And then I try and set up sort of like my little gauntlets and stuff like that so that they're blowing their hit dice early, taking yes. advantage of that, and then throw something a little bit more challenging at them. My player set up something. So before getting to the door that the Aboleth was behind, they found a hidden room that basically in this gauntlet, this thing that's being broadcast on television, they got to face all of these enemies. But the way to get out of there is there's a portal room. There's 4 empty sockets that need these sort of like mana gem type things in them. And those mm-hmm. gems are somewhere in the gauntlet. So you got to work your way through it, defeat the foes, get those. I set it up because there was a smaller version of it that they used in the guy's hideout to open the portal that brought them here. So they know what they have to do. But they found a room off to the side that looked like it had some mana gems in it. This is like just almost near the entrance where they came in. It was mimics. Again, not like a difficult encounter. They'd encountered mimics in their previous version of the gauntlet. So that they didn't know was a gauntlet. It was just sort of the maze that they went through to get to the guy's hideout. So they knew it was coming. They were all careful about that. But in fighting the mimics, they attracted like these giants that were sort of down a hallway that had broken down, opening into a cave. And they knew that was there too. And that was where we'd sort of picked up the session this past week. And a couple of players had spent the week thinking about a different combo that they could do. Pretty cool idea to get into like how to control the giants while they dealt with this and sort of was a great idea. I rewarded them for it. I actually sort of gave them an opportunity to juice it even beyond what they were looking to do with some extra rolls, and they rolled extremely well. It's like that Jack Nicholson gif of him nodding his head because they're doing this and it's awesome and they're burning through like spell slots, right?
Yep.
And I know that these giant things are just like dudes in the hallway. Like they're not the main encounters in this gauntlet. And they're setting up awesome stuff and burning through the spell slots. And it's just like, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So you get to the end of it. Now let's see how you do when you don't have those spell slots.
Yep.
That's where it's handy to have things like wands and scrolls and magic items. But you've got to think about interesting ways to use those things, and that's what makes the game fun.
Yeah, and my players are pretty creative. They're so creative that it almost like isn't worth me trying to set up anything too complex, right? Because they're going to come up with a solution for it anyway, and I'm going to have to try and improvise around it in the middle of the session to try and figure out a way to create a sense of challenge and difficulty sometimes. Even if it isn't, you know, bodily harm or death saving throws or something like that, find extra levels of engagement on the fly because they came up with some really cool thing that I'm not going to say no, right? Like that's an awesome idea. And of course it would probably work here. So we'll let it work.
Yeah. And that's how it should work. Right? Mm-hmm. Everybody should have some input into the awesome, I guess.
Yeah.
Or everyone's awesome input ought to be rewarded. Every good boy deserves fudge. that's a joke for all you music nerds out there.
So going back to your game, you said we didn't get to something that you'd prepped. Any hints?
It is something that will be tied to your backstory that you don't remember, but not in a direct way. And it's something that I'm toying with the idea, because I don't know how to split the party in Foundry, and I don't think I'm going to bother. But I might just pull you and Rich into a private room for a discussion that the others don't hear.
Okay.
So I'm interested to see how that'll work out, because it is something that is sort of specific to your two characters.
Okay. Ooh.
Well, it depends on which direction you go, because there's two sort of ways that can happen. So I have that in my mind. We might end up playing a reasonably short session on Sunday, depending on how that works out. Because there's a couple of, like, it's one of those fork in the road type plot points. So in one direction, it's like, okay, I have to do a whole bunch of reading. And in the other, it's like, okay, I have to make a whole bunch of stuff up. But it's one of those things too, where sometimes, like, I think, oh, I have to have all of this stuff prepared. But in reality, like, if you want to play a 2 or 3 hour session, it's like you need 2 or 3 reasonable encounters.
If that. That's
generally enough. Yeah. And sometimes the first one takes, like, because there was all those monsters that were in that dungeon, and that was basically like 1.5 type encounters.
Like, not even, because it was just like, you know, low CR, but also low count, right? Like, you know, you had your trash heap or whatever the hell it's called. I don't even remember. Shambling Mound.
Shambling Mound.
Yeah. Which, you know, action economy is a thing. And, you know, when you got 5 people against 1, it can trivialize the combat pretty quickly.
It depends. It depends so much on who goes first, because if it's one of those things where you got like a big monster with lots of hit points, but if it goes first, it could kill somebody.
Yeah.
But if it goes last, it probably dies before it acts. There will be some more complicated, you know, strategic combats and tactical situations that come up.
That'll work well. I think it'll give Rich and I something to have our characters tackle strategically while also giving everybody else something to do. Not to say that the other players can't do that, but the way they're playing their current characters, they're not approaching fights that way.
No.
You know, where Rich and I are still trying to be very sneaky and whatnot.
Flanking. Flanking is a thing. And you guys are, you know, you're coordinating pretty well, but it is sort of, it fits their characters though. Cause like Chris is like a new paladin. He's like, rah, 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 charge in and poke them for D4, you know, and, you know, Cindy's
a barbarian.
And it's like, I run in and I hit things. And, you know, Tanya's being the agent of chaos that she is. Sometimes doing things like, I'm like, okay, that's bard-like. And sometimes it's like, what are you doing now?
When she plays video games, she always sort of falls into the archetype of playing like the rogue character that doesn't sneak, but's got like dual wielding weapon, stabby stab kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't seem to want to play a rogue, but she wants to play other classes kind of like a rogue. Like, I swear, she could play wizard and she would want to get in there and start bopping things on the head with a weapon, because that's just kind of what she enjoys. Oh, and it is fun watching her try and twist other characters into that, whether it's a bard, whether, you know, her brief flirtation with druid, or it's nice to break the mold on that stuff. Like, it isn't a criticism at all.
No, it was neat watching her play a druid, because it was very much not druid like.
No.
But it was interesting, and it was a good way to play a druid.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, do you want to wrap things up?
Let's wrap it up.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Anybody want a peanut?
I have a parting gift.
Yeah, you've already talked about it a little bit.
I have. The Bane Free Library is a thing where some sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction, whatever, is available. Like, they make the first 1 or 2 books of series that are kind of almost out of print now available for free in various, like, there's an EPUB, there's a PDF, there's a Word document. which is maybe a little dangerous. I don't know. Do you trust people on the internet with a Word document of your work of fiction? But whatever. And it's an interesting look as well, because a lot of it is older stuff, and it's especially useful, I think, for young people, because that the speculative fiction that was being written at a time, I think, is a better window into how people were thinking at that time than, for example, The Simpsons or Married with Children, which were both not even remotely grounded in any kind of reality. And we're intended to be satire of everything. Anyway, there's some very good books there. There's some absolute and utter crap, as there are in any amount of pulp fiction. But it's worth a look. It's free. You can read it at work. Don't, because that would be wrong, but totally do.
How dare you?
If you have a bullshit office job, you can spend a bunch of time reading and people still think you do a bunch of work. Like if you work in a call center, for example. Which is where I discovered the Bane Free Library.
I would never. I took my call center's job super seriously.
Yeah, me too. I never hung up on anybody except for that one day when I hung up on like 40 people. I apologize to all of you.
Well, it's been good talking to you, man.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. There's a lot of stuff.
Let's not wait a month before we do it again.
Yes, please.